accession number 15735 real one.
Mr. Parrott, real one. Where were you born, please?
In Verwood, Dorset.
Which year was this?
1923.
What did your father do for a living?
Whole variety of things. He was a potter, I think, at the time I was born. He worked as a gardening labourer. He eventually became a postman, and then from postman, I think he went into insurance, and he was an insurance agent up to the war. He was eventually called up and went into the RAF, not the Red Caps, but the Blue Cap Police. And he had quite a time going backwards and forwards to France, picking up German prisoners and bringing them back to the UK. And after that, he stayed on in the army, in the RAF for quite a while, joining the civilian RAF police. And he served at Boscombe Down and the American base at Ruislip and places like that until he retired.
Did you go to school in Verwood?
I did until I was about 12 when the family moved to Wimborne.
How old were you when you finished your education?
As far as a boy was concerned, I left home to join the traineeship Arethusa, down on the Medway, which is part of the Shaftesbury Homes set-up.
At what age were you then?
Just under 14.
Why did you decide to do that?
I think mainly because a young chap in another village, then in the Navy, I think it was the lure of the uniform and this sort of thing that attracted me to an eventual career, as I hoped, in the Navy. And I was very keen to get away from Verwood and to make a start. And the Arethusa seemed a way of doing it. It wasn't that I was sent there as because I didn't have a home or anything like that. There was no problem in that respect, but this was deemed to be a good thing at the time.
How long was the course on the Arethusa?
It lasted for about 15 months, and I joined the Navy in June 1939.
What were conditions like in the Arethusa?
For me, as a fairly weak boy, tough, you were washing the decks in salt water, in barefoot, come summer or winter. You sometimes had to holystone the decks. But half your time was spent at school, but the subjects were more or less limited to the same as they were in the Navy, to English, maths, naval history, and a bit of geography and history. Nothing beyond that. But it was half-time school and half-time professional things. You would do like boat drill, signals training, going aloft. They had this thing had four masts, and they were very tall. You were only allowed up to the first yardarm.
How were you treated by those in charge?
Reasonably well. I mean, we were a crew of, I think it was 240 boys. There was an enormous coke boiler, and coal and coke boiler down in the basement. All the engines had been taken out. And one of your duties, if you're on night watch, was to go down and stoke this thing. We had to coal ship, which involved everybody getting quite dirty, to say the least. You had to go over the side and chip away that rust and paint the side with red oxide, I think it was, paint. And but it wasn't a bad life. The food was not, shall we say, particularly good. I mean, after all, it was part of the Shaftesbury home setup. So the only time we got a really good meal was when we had a visit from one of the chairmen of the Shaftesbury homes. I think it was he'd been an admiral, the Earl of Cork and Orrery. I do remember that. We had such a good meal. But we used to get food parcels from home. You know, my mother would send me cakes and things like that. And if you had cakes, you had friends. This was fine. And I finished that, as I say, in June 1939, and came down to St. Vincent, the proper Navy, in the June 39.
What was the Shaftesbury home set up?
Well, it was a home for boys who I think had been abandoned or whatever. The outer user was a little bit different, of course, from the nature of the thing, but I think it still took boys of that sort and people like myself who wanted to go on and do a career in the Navy. I mean, at that time, although there was the threat of war, we didn't realise it. And, because the war, in effect, spoilt the Navy as a possible career anyway.
What do you think your time in the Arethusa gave to you in terms of qualities or preparation for what was to come later?
I suppose an ability to some extent to look after myself, completely different world to what I'd been used to, and it did make you self-reliant to some extent, although, as I said, I wasn't a particularly healthy boy at that time, and I spent a certain amount of time in the sick quarters. I think I spent as much time there as anybody at the time. But
were the sicknesses because of conditions aboard?
Oh, no. I can't honestly say that. I do remember having mumps and one or two other ailments. I ended up in Rochester Hospital at one stage because I thought I had mastoids, which at that time, of course, they weren't the drug. This is the behind the ear, and it usually meant an operation. But a few days in Rochester Hospital, they managed to bring that down and back aboard.
Had you thought at that time that the war was coming?
Oh, yes, because in 1938, the ship was moored more or less opposite Chatham Dockyard, and the activity there was tremendous, to say the least, even then. And I think even at our tender age, we realised that things were going to happen.
But that didn't alter your ideas about joining the Navy?
Oh, no. The war hadn't started, and of course, when I got down to St. Vincent in 1939, we had 6 weeks initial training, a basic course that all boys, whatever their eventual career was going to be, went through. And we were all home on summer leave when the war broke out. And didn't realise then, but the next thing I knew, we'd got railway warrants and instructions, and never went back to St. Vincent. We went straight over to the Isle of Man to what was called HMS St. George. We took over an existing holiday camp, and conditions were quite tough there. Being a holiday camp, and it was not really equipped to live in during the winter. And that first winter, I wouldn't know how many boys actually went down with diphtheria, but I was certainly one of them. And I was cleared after a few weeks, came out back and rejoined a class. 2 weeks later, I had another swab back in the hospital with carrying diphtheria. And this happened twice, which delayed me from actually going to sea for by about 5 months, I think. So that I was unable to catch up with my original class, which turned out to be quite fortunate later on, because I think I lost a lot of those original colleagues at sea. They went to various ships, but I didn't actually leave the Isle of Man until I think it was August 1941, when I joined HMS Malaya, which was a battleship.
In what capacity?
As a signal boy. There are several other signal boys. We had a large communication staff there. And because the signal boys training was the longest of any of the various grades, signal boy and wireless operators. There again, in St. George, it was half-time schooling, half-time you were professional subject. So we were doing signals, semaphore, Morse, flags, the lot. And then we got aboard the Malaya, and we were into the real thing, of course.
Was it a happy ship for you?
Yes. Rather overwhelmed because of the size of the thing, and being an old, I think she was just about in the First World War. She was rather old, but quite happy, I think. Well, there were so many boys there, colleagues and all the rest of it. We enjoyed ourselves to a certain extent, as much as you could. After working up around Scapa Flow, which was quite interesting, dreadful weather, one of the things I particularly remember was that we had a couple of Oerlikon guns fitted, one each side of the flag deck. And as the signalmen were always there on the spot, some of us were trained to use these Oerlikon guns. And for this training, we had to go up to a place called the Northern Gunnery Range in somewhere on the Orkneys there. And we had to be issued with sea boots. Now, when you think of sea boots these days, you think of Wellingtons, but these were the old leather things, and the ones I had didn't fit properly, and all I remember about it really is coming back with enormous blisters. But we did firing out over the sea, and I had one experience on the ship of they had, for training purposes, they had a plane come over with a drogue target behind it, and I was able to fire at that. I didn't do too badly, but I never had to fire the thing in anger, thank goodness. And one of our first, once we'd finished our working up, the first trip was down to Gibraltar, where we joined Force H. And one of my first duties as a signalman was to take a signal coming from, it was either the Nelson, or pretty sure it was the Nelson, it was a flagship, and included in the address were the names of a lot of flower class corvettes, and I was trying to read signals with names like Chrysanthemum and Coreopsis, and this isn't making sense. these little things stick out in your mind. But of course, the main task we were doing in Force H was to escort the carriers. I think it started with the Eagle and Argus. We would load up with Hurricanes and Spitfires, go to within about 100 miles or so of Malta. These would fly off, and then we would return to Gibraltar. They were joined later by the Ark Royal, I think it was the Ark Royal and Argus, on one of these trips when We were never attacked or anything like that, but these Italian planes would circle round just out of range, more or less keeping an eye on us, just waiting for the planes to take off, I think. I was on the return from one of these trips. It was lovely weather, brilliant sunshine. We on the Malaya had done a 15-inch shoot, and the Art Royal was flying planes off, and that was when she was torpedoed.
Did you see anything of the loss of the Ark Royal?
No, because immediately the Malaya and the Argus increased speed and headed back to Gibraltar with all speed. I think two or three destroyers were left with the Ark Royal, and I think it took her about 14 hours or something like that to actually sink. And I don't think they actually lost a single crew member as a result of this. So that was, then of course, when we got back to Gibraltar, all the Art Royal people were spread around the various ships.
What effect on morale did it have to lose such?
Oh, well, we were all, I mean, the Art Royal had such a reputation. I think everyone thought she was immortal, and of course, nothing is. And it was a tremendous shock. So we had one brief visit home. We were in I'm not sure whether it was Liverpool or one of the Scottish ports. We picked up a convoy, and we took this straight down the middle. And we were issued with Arctic clothing. We went north to some point northwest of Iceland, I would imagine, then more or less straight down the middle of the Atlantic, trying to avoid submarines, because it was quite a large convoy and it was full of troops. They were all full of troops. And we stopped at Freetown, and it was there. By then I was a signalman, and I was loaned to the Vice Commodore of the convoy for signal duties. And myself and another lad. That was fine. We went on down towards Cape Town. We're still out in the middle of the Atlantic. I've always remembered the almost purple water and the phosphorescence from the ship's bows at night. And getting down near Cape Town, I saw my ship, the Malaya, and a couple of the destroyers just wheel off out of the convoy, and that was the last I saw of her till after the war. I was put ashore in Durban, and that time there was a large transit camp, Clarewood Camp, outside Durban, and I spent some time when they realised I was in signals. The petty officers in the police office collared me for telephone duties, and one day I was sent into Durban itself to the naval headquarters with a message of some sort, and took this into the signal office, and the chief yeoman there said, who are you? Where are you from? I said, I've just come off the Malaya. Messing around at Clarewood Camp. He said, I want you. The next day I was in there, and that was that. And that was fine. I think it was about 17 months there. And so for that part of the war, Durban then, plenty of food, plenty of everything. It was a marvellous place to be. You could hardly step outside the barracks and somebody be offering you a lift and taking you to their home and all the rest of it. And, this was at the time when the Jap War had started, and the Prince of Wales and Repulse were sunk, and we had a lot of the survivors that by then had reached South Africa. They were just waiting on the transit home, of course, and meanwhile there have been phone calls for people to go out to various homes, and I went on a visit to a family. He was the station master at a little place called North Dean, in a few miles outside Durban. They were marvellous to me, and after I got into this signal office in Durban, we were all given the opportunity to live out if we wanted to, and these people were very kindly took me in, and I stayed with them for about 3 months, which was marvellous. I was able to go in on the train to work and back in the evening, or whenever, because we were still doing watch keeping. Most of the staff were Wrens. One night I was on duty, and the signal came in from the Admiralty, an acknowledge of the whereabouts of Sigmund J.H. Ferris. So nobody'd ever really caught up with me. I often thought since then, well, if I'd just gone off into nowhere in South Africa, who knows what would have happened. But it was a very enjoyable time because of the ideal peacetime conditions in effect in Durban. But eventually they decided it was time I went back to sea, and I was joined the Quality, one of the Q class destroyers, and for the next few months we did various duties all around the Indian Ocean, escorting the occasional troop ship, or going from Mombasa to Aden, from Aden to Bombay, Bombay to Ceylon, once round to Madras, various trips of that sort, generally two destroyers at a time with a troop ship, or possibly on our own if we were just making our way back to wherever. Then in Bombay, I'd finished my 2.5 years service, and I came home on a troop ship. I think it was the Otranto. There was a lot of those troop ships of that name, of that class then. And had about 6 or 7 weeks leave, and this took me up to just prior to D-Day. And I rejoined HMS Mercury, the signal school at Lady. And for D-Day, I was put on to a depot ship in the Solent. It was a converted merchantman, it was the Empress of Russia. And we were a depot ship for tugs. We had about 60 tugs of all shapes and sizes. And we were supposed to try and make communication with these things, which was extremely difficult, to say the least. But then, of course,
was it HMS Empress of Russia then?
I'm not sure whether she had been named that as part of the wartime thing. We were eventually joined by the headquarters of a Captain D destroyer flotilla, more or less, also lining up for D-Day. Then, of course, D-Day happened, and rather than having the great loss of ships that they anticipated, with all these tugs there to try and tow things back, I don't think they lost anything very much in that way, so the tugs were not needed. We were there for a while, and one of the memories, of course, is the flying bombs coming across Portsmouth, and you could see them on a particular corner of the Isle of Wight. You could time them to the half hour, and Of course, none of them actually landed anywhere near us at all, but that was just part of it.
Where was the Empress of Russia?
Well, she was anchored down off Leon Solent. There was at that time, the Leon Solent had a tower, part of the peacetime setup, I think, and we did manage one or two to get ashore once or twice, but of course, all through D-Day, everything was very much restricted. After that, after coming off the... Oh, in fact, I came off the Empress of Russia into Hasler because I contracted, I think it was the conditions or whatever, gingivitis, and I had a really bad mouth. I had a couple of weeks in Hasler. Then back to Mercury, and from there, I think I went to the hospital at Park Pruitt, because another chap and I, they eventually caught up with us for a hernia operation. And I spent my 21st birthday in Park Pruitt, which was, of course, subsequently a mental hospital. But it was a wartime EMS hospital. And nowadays, when you think that you're going for a hernia operation and you have 2 days, then I was made to stay in bed for 17 days. And the sister caught me out of bed after 14 days and I was in... gave me hell, you know. Ridiculous. But we made ourselves useful because we had quite a lot of wounded coming in from France on the ward, and this other chap and myself used to go around helping to shave, just take bedpans around and all this sort of thing. Eventually, I think it was about 6 or 7 weeks, they decided they'd better send us back to the Navy. They couldn't really keep us any longer. And so it's back to Mercury. And then, just for good measure, they gave us a couple of weeks sick leave on top of that. But then the Japanese war was still on, and sent to Liverpool to join... there was another Empress boat, but I can't remember the name, as a troop ship going to Canada. Quite a lot of us going over there as crews for minesweepers, which they were building in Port Arthur, which is at the top of Lake Superior. I think it's now called Thunder Bay. Port Arthur and Fort William seem to have joined up and go under one name. And this minesweeper wasn't ready, but before that, of course, the VJ happened. We were actually on Montreal Station, I think, at the time, because you landed at Quebec, went from Quebec to Montreal to Toronto, and then it was a 26-hour train journey from there to Port Arthur. The ships weren't ready, and we had a marvellous time there, because again, the Canadians had all the food and everything else that we were so lacking here. And we, even in the actual barracks, we were fed very well indeed. My friend and I got ourselves a job where we did the washing up for just about 200 people, I think. But as a result, we were able to go out on leave at odd times, and we became friendly with a couple of nurses from the McKellar General Hospital down at Fort William. And they, I think, more or less took us around, because we were given $4 a week, I think it was.